welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Tuesday, May 30. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, Earlville returns to tradition to mark Memorial Day. This story is by Brittany Miller and includes photos of the veterans who are marching in the Earlville Parade. On Monday, red, white, and blue colored the rolling hills of gray headstones and green grass in the Fairview Cemetery. The tiny American flags dotting the graves flickered with life in a soft breeze. Three larger flags stood tall in the center of the cemetery, the ceremony square, where a small crowd gathered in the morning. Monday was the first Memorial Day marked in Fairview Cemetery in Earlville since the COVID-19 pandemic began. In 2020 and 2021, the ceremony transitioned to a car and golf cart parade around town, complete with homes decorated in American memorabilia. Last year, it took place in the neighboring St. Joseph's Cemetery, a larger space with more room for attendees to spread out. Now the small town has gathered in its traditional spot once again. "It's like going back home," said Loris Menson, commander of the Earlville Carpenter Deesh White American Legion Post 436, since 2004. He's been part of the Legion for nearly 30 years and spent 23 years in the Army Reserves. The American Legion is a nationwide veterans service organization with posts around the country. Earlville's Legion hosts fundraisers and attends funerals, football games, and parades. It has 37 members, Menson said. He estimated there are between 45 and 50 veterans within city limits, and every year they gather to commemorate and honor veterans on Memorial Day. The Memorial Day event began with about 10 members of the Legion marching into the ceremony square, rifles resting on their shoulders and flags in their hands. They turned to face the three tall flagpoles where Menson stood. He started with a prayer, and a student from a local high school sang the national anthem. Then, his voice trembling with emotion, he read a poem about a soldier standing before God at the gates of heaven called The Final Inspection. Shannon Richardson, a member of the Legion, spoke about the real meaning of the word sacrifice, the act of giving up something valued for the sake of something else regarded more worthy. He pointed out the many flags alongside gravestones, a symbol of sacrifice by service members. On this beautiful day, this long weekend, this day of going to the lake for grilling in the backyard, or gathering family and friends, let's all pause, he said. Let's remember and pray for those that sacrificed their lives for the betterment of us. The Legion awarded three $100 checks to the Earlville Fire and Ambulance Department, the Earlville Community Club, and the Boy Scouts. A rendition of Amazing Grace followed, along with a closing prayer and the sounding of taps. An end-of-the-day military bugle call, now used during military memorial ceremonies and funerals. Finally, the ceremony concluded with an iconic three-volley salute from the Legion's firing squad. The booms of the rifles reverberated around the graves of the men and women they were honoring. Hilda DeMuth was among the attendees watching the ceremony. Her husband was in the Army for 6 years and then the Air Force for 20 years. On Monday, she sat in the Fairview Cemetery with a faux poppy pinned to her sleeve and a scarf dotted with American flags around her neck. No matter where they lived, DeMuth, age 78, said she was very proud to be a military wife. Her husband is now part of Earlville's Legion and participated in the Memorial Day ceremony. We knew that he was military first and family second, she said with a chuckle. That's the one time you can say that. She was active in Guttenberg's American Legion Auxiliary, which is the national organization formed to support members of the American Legion. Doug Steele, age 46, was part of the ceremony. He had been in the National Guard for 8 years, stationed in Waterloo. He has now been part of Earlville's Legion for about 6 years. His 41-year-old wife, Amy, and 16-year-old son, Levi, came to support him at the Memorial Day service. It's a great honor to have him serve and to be part of it, Amy Steele said. We're here to celebrate servicemen who are living and who are not here. Al Otting, age 84, was in the Army for 2 years, from 1963 to 1964, and then in the Legion for 23 years. He has come to Earlville's Memorial Day ceremony almost every year and remembers when there were more participants. "We're getting down there to where there's not many even in the Legion anymore," he said. "Every year it's getting less." Menson said participation in Earlville's Legion has gradually decreased due to difficulties recruiting new veterans, but many attendees have still returned year after year on Memorial Day to honor veterans. At 97, Viola DeMoss is the oldest lifetime resident of Earlville, and she said she has never missed a veterans program. She's a second-generation immigrant from the former Yugoslavia. Her grandfather served in the Spanish-American War, her husband served in World War II, and several of her kids and grandchildren were in the service. "I'm proud of them. I'm thankful for everything they do," she said. "I just wouldn't ever miss this event. This country's important to me." Also on the front page today, this story from Davenport is by Sarah Watson and Tom Geyer. No deaths reported in Davenport building collapse. From the Quad City Times, one person was injured, but no deaths have been confirmed when a six-story downtown Davenport apartment building partially collapsed Sunday evening after occupants said they had been complaining about conditions there for months. Davenport city officials said in a news release the property owner was served Monday with an order to demolish the unstable building, which is expected to start today. The Davenport apartment building, 324 Main Street, once housed the Davenport Hotel but has been converted into about 84 units with apartments and commercial spaces. Residents were not being allowed back inside to remove their belongings due to the building's instability. Several tenants have been moved into temporary housing and the rest are staying with family or friends. The property is currently being secured by a contractor on site this afternoon, and demolition is expected to commence in the morning, the statement said. In a statement, property owner Andrew Wold offered prayers and thanks and offered to help displaced residents. "We are saddened by this tragic event and we are thankful that it appears no one was killed. Our thoughts and prayers are with those who've been injured or displaced. We are grateful to the brave men and women of Davenport Fire and Police, city officials, and all other emergency responders who were able to safely evacuate the building and rescue the trapped individual. We will continue to assist the city and the displaced residents any way we can. In the coming days, we will work with city officials to understand the causes of this tragedy." Firefighters and other first responders were being credited with saving lives at great risk to their own safety, officials said on Monday. "When something like this happens here and tragedy strikes, our responders immediately do their work and their job, and I can't thank them enough," Mayor Mike Mattson said. Fire Chief Michael Carlston said crews and canine units searched for survivors throughout the night and rescued one injured person and seven others. Iowa Task Force 1, an urban search and rescue team based in Cedar Rapids, was called in to help. The city was trying to cross-reference information on tenants with the property owner, Carlston said, but not every person had a cell phone or second means of contact. "No known individuals were trapped in that facility," Carlston said, but some relatives said their loved ones still were missing. Antoine Smith Jr. of Rock Island said he's been looking for his aunt, Lisa Brooks, and can't find her after inquiring at the Red Cross and other services. Smith said he has left his aunt's name with the Davenport Police Department. "Brooks was born January 5, 1970," he said. Smith said he is praying she's not in the rubble, but if the building comes down Tuesday, he wants to know if anyone will be looking for her. Mildred Harrington, Brooks's daughter-in-law, lives with Brooks. She said she went to the store, but before she returned, the building gave way. She said no one had heard from Brooks. Harrington, too, lost all her belongings except the clothes she was wearing. She's staying with a relative, but isn't sure what to do next. Tenant Lexis Berry said she watched as her apartment collapsed with her wife still inside. Rescuers located and pulled her wife, Kanisha White Berry, from the rubble overnight after being pinned for hours. She said her wife went into surgery. "We are very blessed, but this is going to change our lives forever," she wrote in a text message. The building collapsed just before 5 p.m. Sunday. Carlson said the back of the complex separated from the mixed-use building, which houses apartments and businesses. Authorities also found a gas leak in the building after the collapse. The cause of the collapse is not yet known. Abbreviating that story and turning to the Iowa Today page, this story is by Tom Barton, titled "Iowa DOT Drones Help Get Traffic Moving Again." Iowa's highway helpers could soon have an eye in the sky and a new tool to help them quickly clear traffic for emergency responders at crash scenes. The Iowa Department of Transportation is working with Autobase in the Iowa City area, testing drone use to help monitor and safely and efficiently redirect traffic around wrecks, temporary road closures, and construction to get traffic moving again faster. The project was inspired by Andy Lewis, Traffic Operations Bureau Director of the Iowa DOT, after learning about drones being used in other states to quickly clear traffic. This pilot program got underway in early spring. Iowa DOT's Traffic Management Center in Ankeny uses live video feeds from 500 stationary cameras to assess highway incidents and then to relay information to workers at the scene to get roads cleared as quickly as possible, said Ashley Hochberger, a program manager in the DOT's Traffic Operations Bureau. With a drone, the DOT can quickly get a camera to areas where the department does not have stationary cameras, in addition to providing a bird's-eye view to monitor and manage traffic while early and emergency responders and towing companies work to clear crash scenes. Similarly, drones can help the DOT monitor roadway construction activities to ensure a smooth flow of traffic. The drone being tested in Iowa City has the capability to stream live video as well as take high-resolution still photographs. "Using the drone provides a whole new vantage point that we've not had before," Hochberger said. "This just gives us another set of eyes and a situational awareness to know what's going on so that way we can leverage any resources we have that we can deploy in conjunction with law enforcement." The DOT and Autobase have worked out a process to add a drone to the Highway Helper toolkit. The Highway Helper program is a free service that assists stranded motorists with flat tires, dead batteries, or empty fuel tanks on metro highways. Highway Helper drivers also serve as traffic managers after a crash, setting up barricades and blocking lanes. Their trucks also feature large signs to warn drivers to avoid an accident scene. Highway Helper trucks patrol the freeway and interstate systems and are dispatched to other Iowa DOT roadways in Des Moines, Council Bluffs, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and Quad Cities metro areas. The Iowa DOT Traffic Management Center uses traffic cameras to monitor the roadways and dispatches Highway Helper trucks to needed locations. Travis Schooley, program manager at Autobase, which contracts with the DOT to provide Highway Helper services, said a drone was deployed to monitor recent river flooding in Davenport and assess what roads needed to be closed. The drone also has been used in the Iowa City area to view work zones from the sky to ensure they are set up in a manner that will make sure all elements are positioned correctly to make the area as safe as possible. Flying the drone over the traffic that's backed up gives the DOT and highway helpers a better, more complete view to devise the easiest route to kick them off that's a good route where semis can go through, Schooley said, and stop the queue and get traffic moving a little better until we get the accident cleaned up. Hochberger said drones also can help enhance traffic incident management training and after-action reviews by taking aerial views of how vehicles were positioned. That information can be used to improve safety and better protect crash victims, first responders, and the traveling public. The drones can also work in concert with the DOT's Towing Recovery and Incentive Program, or TRIP, which is aimed at clearing large crashes quickly to prevent traffic from backing up. TRIP recently was expanded to the Des Moines area after proving successful around Iowa City. After getting called to a crash, a towing company that's part of TRIP can receive a $2,500 incentive payment from the Iowa DOT if the scene is cleared within a certain time frame. Nobody likes to be stuck in traffic on the interstate, right? Hochberger said. And at the DOT, we are very big on innovative technology and making data-driven decisions. The drone program is part of that effort to innovate, Hochberger said. Luckily, we already have a great partner with Autobase, so it was fairly seamless to get this up and going and continue the partnership with them. Also in Iowa news, Coralville's Kevin Burt sings praises of Singing the Blues. This story by Diana Nolan. On January 20, 2018, Kevin, known as B.F. Burt of Coralville, was crowned the world's top unsigned blues player, sweeping all three solo categories in the International Blues Challenge in Memphis. Competing against 160 acts from around the world, he earned a first-place finish for Best Solo or Duo Act, the Lee Oscar Award for Best Harmonica Player, and the Cigar Box Guitar Award for Best Solo or Duo Guitarist. Not only was Burt the first contestant to do that, he also was the first solo artist to get a perfect score from a judge. "And I got two," he told the Gazette afterward. Industry and interview requests and emails began pouring in. Record labels came courting, and he realized he needed to hire a manager. "One of the things that I've learned is that I'm remarkably unprepared for now," said Burt, 55, a self-taught musician who didn't pick up a guitar until he was 27. "You go to contests like this with the mindset of, I would like to win, but I forgot to ask myself the question, well, what if you do?" God bless my father-in-law, reggae and world musician Tony Brown. Tony told me, "Kev, you need to have this in place, and this in place, and this in place." The wins launched his career like a rocket, he told the Gazette earlier this month. "I went from a guy that played 350 to 400 shows a year right here within the state of Iowa for the most part, to getting my first European tour, to getting the opportunity to become a recording artist. I went into a studio for the first time, signed my first record deal. It got me nominated for the best recording by an emergency artist in blues at the 2019 Blues Music Awards. It only took me 27 years to be an overnight sensation in the blues world," he said with a hearty laugh. Went from that to COVID, and everything came to a screeching halt. He was performing in San Diego when the shutdowns began in 2020. He started at 6 p.m., but at 7, the owner informed him the governor said the venue had to close by 7:30. And, by the way, he wasn't going to pay Burt and was canceling his hotel room. Patrons who heard the exchange stepped in and insisted the owner honor the agreement. "So, luckily, I was taken care of," Burt said, "but I got on a plane the next day, flew home, and as soon as I turned my phone back on, I had close to $70,000 worth of shows canceled. I went from what was going to be the best year financially that I'd ever had to unemployment for the next 2 years." Being a registered business owner in Iowa with just himself on the payroll, he said he wasn't eligible for unemployment or the Paycheck Protection Program. "Luckily, people were surprisingly generous with online shows," he said. "My wife took a job as a personal shopper, like to go get groceries for folks, and we were able to keep the lights on, eat, and pay the house payment." Emerging from the pandemic, live gigs are picking up for the Iowa Blues Hall of Fame inductee, who was working on regaining his stamina after four bouts with COVID-19. Bert performed for the Gazette's Excellence in Arts High School Student Recognition event April 22nd at CSPS Hall in Cedar Rapids, at the Blues Night in the Park on May 19th in Cedar Rapids Green Square, and right now this weekend he's playing in blues festivals in Belgium and Germany. Back home, he'll be at various sites, including the My Waterloo Days Brunch, Blues and Car Show, which is on June 11, a jazz festival in Aspen, Colorado in late June, and the Iowa City Summer of the Arts Music on the Move on July 11 in Mercer Park. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from Friday's Las Vegas Review-Journal, and the title is Not Perfect, But It's a Start on Immigration Reform. As the debt ceiling showdown moves toward its final stages, a bipartisan House group has offered a path forward on another controversial issue, immigration. Last week, a handful of Democrats and Republicans in the lower chamber announced they would introduce the Dignity Act, which the Washington Post described as the most robust immigration proposal to date this Congress. Notably, the six main co-sponsors, three Republican, three Democrat, are Hispanic members of Congress who represent border states. The primary authors are Representative Maria Elvira Salazar from Florida and Representative Veronica Escobar from Texas. "We're not each pursuing the perfect as we see it," Salazar said. "We are pursuing a compromise that is real, that is common sense." As such, the legislation has something for everyone to hate. It includes beefed-up border security, anathema to progressives, and a pathway to legal status for those in the country illegally, a thorn for conservative border hawks. Under the proposal, Congress would add more Border Patrol agents, as well as additional surveillance technology and border fencing, the Wall Street Journal reported. At the same time, the bill would allow those who have been living in the United States illegally for at least 5 years to pay a $5,000 fine over 7 years to gain protection against deportation. At that point, they could pay another $5,000 fine and gain permanent resident status or start the process of citizenship. The bill also creates processing centers and humanitarian campuses for those awaiting adjudication of their status. Employers, including those in the agricultural business, would face stricter e-verify requirements regarding their workers, the journal notes. The Dignity Act would boost the number of visas and green cards available to meet demand and create a year-round visa program for farm workers, while also quickly deporting those who aren't granted asylum. "Holding out for the perfect will make the situation worse," Escobar said. "I have an ideal vision as well, but if I sit on my hands until I'm able to execute on that, then the situation will only grow more and more challenging." GOP leaders have vowed not to take up immigration reform until passing a border security law. But all these issues are intertwined. There's nothing politically compromising about House Republicans using the Dignity Act as a starting point for serious talks on this contentious issue, showing voters that they're willing to substantively address pressing problems, even if nobody gets everything they want. And again, that is a reprint from the Las Vegas Review. The guest column today by Norm Sherman, from Cheers to Beers to Bourbon. "We gather by the thousands, students, alumni, just folks, to cheer University of Iowa teams. We're happy when they win, sad when they lose. Either way, many students head off at game's end for a drinking party. They go from cheers to beers and bourbon. For most freshmen, drinking is a new sport. Eager to fit in, they have an introductory drink and then more and more. Here, about 40% of students, down from 70% just 10 years ago, end up drinking in a high-risk manner. Some remain problem drinkers, and there would be even more without the staff dedicated to implementing the UI's Alcohol Harm Reduction Plan. The plan uses the National Institutes of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse framework that focuses on both individual interventions and environmental change, including laws, policies, and ordinances. It is emotionally draining work and requires a kind of dedication most of us never have to make at our work. They save lives. I've had two friends die of alcoholism. Both had one drink too many, possibly their first one, certainly their final one. One was a former First Lady of Minnesota and 62 years old. When her husband became ambassador to Iceland, she went quickly from a diplomatic drinker to an addicted one. Later, she also went from a detox center, seemingly successfully dry, to her death in a one-car rollover. She began that day with no thought of danger and certainly not of death. She was simply going to visit family in Texas. The other victim was not yet 20. Home alone in a small Minnesota town, parents off on a couple days of fishing. They came home to a dead son with an empty glass on the floor. He died not peacefully in his sleep, as the cliche goes, but drunk, poisoned by alcohol. They both lived years filled with pain for themselves and family. They were not alone. One study of alcoholism says it is estimated that more than 140,000 people, approximately 97,000 men and 43,000 women, die from alcohol-related causes annually. We have our share of alcoholics in Iowa, and we don't need more. When the governor and the Republican Senate put a glass of alcohol in the hands of a teenager, even just a server, they are signing the death warrant for some. Death and mourning ought not to be sponsored by the state, as we have done here. Some of those servers will become drunks on the way to troubled years and possibly early death. We ought to discourage drinking that turns into a problem of alcoholism for some of those at tailgate parties. For years, we have devoted tax money to deal with alcoholism or the threat of it. It is an important expenditure that could have been less. I wish the governor had talked to university faculty and staff who spend much of their time helping kids who otherwise are on their way, not to graduation, but on their way to besotted failure, not just at school, but for a lifetime. A Bachelor of Alcoholism is not a degree worth earning. The governor should talk to the people at UI for guidance and counseling before another student dies. That's submitted today by Norman Sherman of Coralville, who has worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Herbert Humphrey's press secretary, and wrote a memoir, From Nowhere to Somewhere. We have one community letter today from Cora Sutton of Solon, and the title, Child Immigration Labor Must Be Fixed. Fiscal 2022 saw 152,000 unaccompanied minors encountered at or near the U.S. border. This is an all-time high for America. The New York Times has also found a large number of these unaccompanied minors are being exploited for child labor. Even companies like PepsiCo, owner of Quaker Oats, were found to be using migrant children for cheap labor when they should be in school. Thankfully, after news of this became public, the government decided to do something about child labor. Unfortunately, national progress is lagging because of disagreement between parties. The Iowa legislature is passing laws that apply to child labor, but probably not in a good way. Its legislation would allow 14 and 15-year-olds to work longer hours at more dangerous jobs and would allow kids 16-plus to work the same amount as adults. Overall, we just have a really big problem with child labor in the U.S., and it feels just like we aren't talking enough about it. I can't do much as a high school student, but adults can. America gives you the freedom to be able to speak out and say when things are wrong, and we need to use that to make this change. Again, that's from Cora Sutton in Solon. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, May 30, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page, starting with the short notices. First from Decorah, Vern Koenig, age 101, died Friday, December 16, 2022. Helm's Funeral Home is in charge. In Oxford, Mary Ann Vilhauer, 84, died Sunday, May 28. Arrangements with Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. And from Prairieburg, Julie Walker, 64, died Monday, May 29. Getch Funeral Home, Monticello. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Tipton, Brad Allen Jackson departed this world on Sunday, May 28th, while under the care of Cedar Manor Nursing Home with his wife Kelly by his side. Brad was 55 and was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Brad's family will hold a private graveside funeral service on Sunday, June 4, in the Stanwood Cemetery, where he will be laid to rest. Family and friends are invited to gather on Monday, June 5, from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Matthews Building on the Cedar County Fairgrounds to celebrate Brad's life. Should you feel inclined, memorials may be sent directly to Kelly Jackson. And in lieu of flowers, please consider donating to the ALS Association. Online memorials can be shared with the FryFuneralHome.com. From Atkins, Richard Charles, known as Dick Hare, 83, passed away Thursday, May 25th at the Hiawatha Care Center. A memorial visitation will be held on Friday, June 2nd from 3 to 5 p.m. at Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. Memorial services will be held at 6 p.m. Friday, also at the funeral home, with Deacon Bill Hare and the Reverend Douglas Woltemuth officiating. Phillips Funeral Home is assisting. In Cedar Rapids, Joanne Irene Riegel, 76, born February 3, 1947, in Iowa City. She was preceded in death by her parents and her husband Leonard, brother Steve Fowler, and brother-in-law Max Hansen. Memorials may be sent directly to the family and online condolences submitted to broschchapel.com. She passed away on Saturday, May 27th at West Ridge Care Center. Celebration of Life Gathering will be from 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 3rd at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. Private family interment will be at the Anderson Cemetery in Swisher. From Morley, Paula K. Meyer, 59, passed away Saturday, May 20, at her home after a brave battle with lung and brain cancer. A celebration of Paula's life will be Saturday, June 24, at 1 p.m. at her home in Morley. Burial will be in Green Center Cemetery in rural Morley. Paula served in the Morley City Council for 6 years. Chapman Funeral Home is assisting the family. From South English, Raymond Matthias Gent, born August 30, 1932 in Harper, Iowa, passed away at age 90 on Saturday, May 27, at his home. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, June 1st, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in North English. Burial will be in St. Patrick's Little Creek Cemetery, rural North English. Visitation will be Wednesday from 4 to 7 p.m. with a rosary service at 4 p.m. Powell Funeral Home in North English. Memorials may be directed to Camp Courageous, and the Powell Funeral Home in North English is caring for Raymond and his family. From Walnut Creek, California, Lenora Julia Melzer Spear passed away May 21st in Walnut Creek, where she lived since July of 2016 to be near family following the death of her husband. She was 92 years old. A visitation will be held at the Fry Funeral Home on June 1st from 10 a.m. to noon, followed by a luncheon at noon and graveside service at the Stanwood Cemetery immediately following the luncheon. From Galena, Illinois, Mark F. DeYoung, 75, passed away Monday, May 15th at Midwest Medical Center, Galena. A funeral mass will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 3, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, where friends may gather after 10 a.m. until the time of mass. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Military honors will be accorded graveside by Galena VFW Post 2665 and American Legion Post 193. Cremation rites have been accorded. The Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena is assisting the family. From Iowa City, Douglas Ayer Wallace, 84, died Wednesday, December 7, at Timber City Wellness and Rehab in Maquoketa. A memorial service to celebrate Doug's life will be held at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, June 3rd, at the Unitarian Universalist Society, 2355 Oakdale Road in Coralville. Because of his lifelong attention to and appreciation of our environment's interconnected web of life, remembrances may be made to the Audubon Society, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, or the Baroque Land Trust. A full obituary is available at lensingfuneral.com. And from Homestead, Tammy R. Banwart died Saturday, May 27, at her home, surrounded by family after a courageous battle with cancer. A gathering time for family and friends to remember and support one another will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 31st, at St. Mary's Auditorium, 133 East Main Street in Oxford. To share a memory, thought, or condolence, visit gayandchia.com. A memorial fund has been established for her children. Scrolling past the comic page today, Pluggers is kind of funny. Pluggers are unsure if they have good tan or if their age spots finally all run together. And now turning to the sports page, State of State is the title of this article by Nathan Ford, High School Boys State Soccer. The first day of the Iowa High School Boys State Soccer Tournament, that is perhaps best described as county chaos, gets a new element this year, lights. With the addition of a fourth class, the last games of the day kick off at 7 p.m. or later, a scene that should be worth savoring even more. The first of the 16 quarterfinal games kicks off at 10 a.m. today at County Soccer Park. To get ready for the week, let's run through a few superlatives in each class. In Class 4A, the highest seed is West Des Moines Valley, who has won 10 straight games, giving up a goal in just one. The Tigers are 4-1 against teams in the 4A field, with only a 1-0 setback at Johnston. In Class 3A, the highest seed is Des Moines Hoover. Des Moines Hoover's lone loss was to 2A top-ranked Gilbert 2-1 in a Saturday tournament, but the Huskies haven't faced any 3A or 4A state qualifiers. Third-seeded Dallas Center Grimes was the top-ranked team in the final Coaches Association rankings. And in Class 2A, Davenport Assumption won its third state championship in Class 1A last season and returns to try its hand at 2A. Gilbert entered the regular season as the Coaches Association number one team. And in Class 1A, the highest seed Grundy Center Gladbrook Rhinebeck lost twice by one goal last spring, including to West Liberty in the sub-state finals, and has yet to lose since. Today's games are Class 1A, 2A, 3A, and 4A, all playing at various stadiums. In high school baseball, exciting matchups on tap this week. This story by KJ Pilcher. Baseball began its third week of competition, and teams are knocking off the rust. This upcoming week includes top 10 battles, conference rivalries, and games between teams on a hot streak. Here's a look ahead at some noteworthy matchups this week. Today, Cedar Rapids Kennedy is at Western Dubuque. The Cougars moved up to fifth in the Class 4A rankings, while the Bobcats sit atop 3A for the second straight poll. Both teams have produced stingy pitching with potent offenses. Kennedy is second in the state for runs scored, and Western Dubuque is third. The Cougars score 9.6 runs per game with 5 home runs, including 2 apiece from Colby Dolphin and Grant Mather. Western Dubuque scores at a 10.4 run clip and gives up 4 per contest. The Bobcats are batting .332 with a whopping .497 team on-base percentage, which leads 3A. On Wednesday, West Delaware is at Linmar. The Hawks and Lions are on an upswing. West Delaware, at 6-1, has won 3 straight and 4 of the last 5 games. The Lions, at 7-3, have won 5 in a row and 7 of the last 8. Mid Prairie closed last season with the program's 5th state semifinal appearance. Despite dealing with injuries, the Golden Hawks have extended their success. Other coaches have taken notice. Mid Prairie moved up 1 spot and is ranked number 1 in Class 2A, according to the Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association rankings released on Monday. The Golden Hawks are 5-2 entering today's home River Valley Conference doubleheader against Tipton. They replaced defending state champion Van Meter atop the poll. Turning now to the Business 380 page, Outdoor Movies is the title of this article by Steve Gravel. Joe Nelson wasn't looking to test a new business idea back in 2020's COVID summer. I didn't look at it that way at the time, but that's what it ended up being, said Nelson, age 42 of Cedar Rapids, who had designed and installed home theater systems for a Marion dealer. When the pandemic, I thought, let's do an outdoor setup for myself. Every other Friday during the pandemic, he showed a movie outside his house on his big front yard. We had socially distanced movie night, he said. We had little pods of people and we'd watch movies. As the pandemic grip eased, Nelson thought he'd found a niche. He launched Pop-Up Cinema in late 2021, bringing backyard screenings to others' homes. Going pro meant upgrading his gear. The initial idea was that I could use what I had for my yard and apply it to other people's yards, he said. I quickly learned how not versatile residential consumer-level electronics are if you're trying to make a business out of it, he said. My original investment, within 6 weeks, I quadrupled. Nelson supplies a laser projector, screen, and speakers, all tailored to the expected audience size. The screens are inflated by a blower in a soundproof enclosure and then staked down. You need a lot of brightness if you want to start before it's super dark out, said Nelson, who advises customers to schedule their showings 15 to 30 minutes after sunset. Right after sunset, it's still pretty light, he said. You need a lot more power than when you're in a room and can control the lights. Nelson also had to become familiar with trademark and copyright law. I had to learn a lot about legalities of what we can show where and when, he said. Even if it's not public, even if you're not making money, and if you're outside your house and there are people who aren't your family coming to see it, you need a license. So Nelson's fee includes licensing to download the film on his MacBook Pro hard drive. He also can live stream sports and customers' own videos for weddings and things like that where you'd want to show slides. Most of Nelson's screenings are for publicly sponsored events, like family movie nights in a city park, and a lot of football fields and town center parks in surrounding towns, he said. We could draw a couple hundred people. I don't know that I like one more than the other. The city ones use bigger gear, so they pay more. But the birthday parties are pretty chill, a lot less stress, almost the perfect trade-off. Nelson charges a mileage fee, and I'll drive anywhere for that price. The farthest I've gone is as far up into northern Iowa, 150 miles or so. That was on a farm, one of those educational farms, a big crowd. Spring and fall have proved to be his busy seasons. Summers are tricky because it gets dark so darn late, he said. Last fall was great. Spring and fall are the best for the light. Family Fair dominates Nelson's screenings. Last Halloween, we did show the actual Halloween movie, the only adult-centered thing I've shown, he said. If you're going to have it on a giant screen outside, you really can't have any nudity or anything like that. PG is about as much as it's going to get. The initial idea was that I could use what I had for my yard and apply it to other people's yards. And the article shows the huge screen that Joe Nelson uses to project. He ties down the inflatable screen at a client's home in Cedar Rapids. And again, it's titled Pop-Up Cinema. The owner is Joe Nelson. The website is popupcinemacr.com. And you can phone Joe at 319-423-9687. Also in Business 380 News, I'm On Communications is launching a free public Wi-Fi at Pepperwood Plaza in the south of 6 Iowa City Business District. The free internet connection will be available outside the plaza's South District Market and outside Dream City, that's located at 611 Southgate Avenue. We're thrilled to partner with the new business district to bring free public Wi-Fi to these vibrant community hubs on the south side of Iowa City, said Patrice Carroll, CEO of IMON Communications. And Collins delivers training systems for the U.S. Navy. Collins Aerospace has announced delivery of a technical combat training system for the U.S. Navy. The system, TCTS-2, allows air crews to train and improv joint tactics, techniques, and procedures in an NSA-certified secure environment, said John Sapp, Vice President and General Manager of Integrated Solutions for Collins, a Raytheon company, and the largest private employer in Cedar Rapids. The system's long-range air-to-air and air-to-ground networking systems supports real-time exchanges of data for FA-18 and EA-18G aircraft, the company said in a news release. The system features an open architecture design, high encryption capability, computer power, and a robust data link. It will be the foundation for next-generation training that will use a combination of live, virtual, and constructive entities, the news release stated. Turning now to the community page, this Eastern Iowa brief is from Iowa City. PS1 will hold its Open Air Media Festival Saturday night. The fourth annual Open Air Media Festival will take place at 8:30 p.m., at PS1's Close House, location 538 South Gilbert Street in Iowa City, and will feature time-based projects, video projection works, and performances by 15 Iowa-based artists, and a screening program of 19 artists from the greater Midwest. The inaugural festival was created in the summer of 2020 to provide exhibition opportunities for media artists and art viewing experiences for the public in outdoor locations. The 2023 festival is curated by Zen Cohen, director and founder of the festival, and Dana Potter, assistant program director and graphic design lead, and will continue this mission while illuminating the Close House property with inspiring, challenging, and thought-provoking works. It invites the public to explore larger-than-life art experiences. As in previous years, a live radio broadcast of performances and artist interviews will be aired on KRUI-FM 89.7 during the festival. The festival is free. The artwork showcased in this year's festival ranges in format from shadow theater and sound collage to projection mapping and performance, and addresses topics from grief and healing to humans' relationships to plants and the environment. And also a story here by Diana Nolan titled Corridor Community Bands Are Ready for Summer Concerts. It's time to strike up the summer band, so roll out the drums, blow out the cobwebs, shine up the bells, and buy a new reed or two. The corridor's community bands typically play a mix of music, from show tunes to patriotic melodies, at their free concerts. And of course, in the state, America's March King, Carl King, called home for much of his adult life, audiences will hear plenty of marches. They may even hear King's Iowa Band Law, a march he wrote to commemorate the Iowa Band Law, passed in 1921, giving cities permission to levy a local tax to maintain their band. The band tax was one of many purpose-specific levies eliminated under the property tax reform bill passed this session. While the area's ensembles generally sit in concert formation, the Marion Community Band has been marching between Marion sites during recent construction uptown. The group even marched abroad in the 1988 Austrian National Band Festival in Vienna. After playing in different spots and in Marion Square Park the past couple years, the concert and jazz bands will be playing farther afield this year, moving to the pavilion area at Thomas Park, 343 Marion Boulevard, to sidestep even more construction at Marion Square. The ensemble will be easy to spot in its temporary locale. Just head toward the portable band shell that will wheel into Thomas Park. Longtime followers know they'll hear America the Beautiful and Stars and Stripes. But this time, director David Law is shooting for the stars, adding music from The Mandalorian, a wildly popular Star Wars TV spinoff featuring a big-eyed little guy, commonly called Baby Yoda. Law hinted to the Gazette that he may have other Star Wars fare up his sleeve as well. And he said the Marion Ensemble, he founded in 1982, will be the first community band and one of the first bands in Iowa to perform the Space Force March, Semper Supra, meaning always above. It's a natural fit since the Marion Concert Band always plays the Armed Forces Medley, recognizes those who served in the military now and in the past. The Space Force theme is in the same 6/8 time as the Air Force song, so we'll just segue right in, Law said. We'll cue the percussion for another 6/8 and go right into Space Force. There's probably some parents out there whose kids are in the Space Force. So what keeps the retired band director at the baton with the Marion Group for nearly 41 years? The people, he said. It's just fun. The Cedar Rapids Municipal Band has been bringing music to the park and venue since 1948, but according to the band website, the tradition of Sunday night concerts in the park dates back to the 1890s. The 2023 season gets underway June 7 outside the History Center. The season wraps up August 6 near the Grand Avenue entrance to Beaver Park. You can view their details online at crmuniband.org. Iowa City Community Band is gearing up for the summer, and its Facebook page says it also welcomes anyone who enjoys playing band music. The ensemble typically plays in Iowa City and Coralville Parks during June and July, as well as local festivals, an ice cream social in Iowa City's Upper City Park, and Coralville's 4th of July celebration. Watch for their schedule at facebook.com/ICC Band. And the Washington, Iowa Municipal Band launches its season at 8 p.m. Thursday at Central Park Fountain. The volunteer ensemble will perform each Thursday night through August 17. For details, go to washingtoniowa.gov/organizer/Washington Municipal Band. Finishing up with the weather story, the 2023 Atlantic hurricane season begins in just a few days, on June 1st. Meteorologists at the National Hurricane Center predict that we'll see a near-normal season this year, expecting between 12 and 17 storms, 5 to 9 hurricanes, and 1 to 4 major storms. This year's hurricane season is expected to be less active as compared to previous years. And El Nino likely will occur this summer. El Nino is bad for tropical storms in the Atlantic since they increase wind shear, which is known to tear apart tropical storms. We're looking for a warm week with highs in the upper 80s to low 90s. The normal high is 76 today. The normal low is 55. A record of 96 was set in 1934 and a record low of 33 in 1924. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. This is Tuesday, May 30. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Have a great, safe day.